couldn't rest with this damn cough, she muttered. He heard Gehanu's choppy accent in her words. She narrowed her eyes at him then, looking him up and down. Ache, the handsome boy who joined us in Gujara. They give you take care of the old woman duty for the night? Ehuru smiled. It would be an honor if they had, Elder, but no. I have come for a different purpose. He paused while she coughed again, harshly and with obvious pain. A flask of water and a cup sat on a tray nearby. When the spasm passed, he poured water for her and lifted this to her lips, holding it while she sipped. She nodded thanks when she was done. Setting the cup down, he paused for a moment, and then reached into his robes for his waist pouch. Pulling it out, he opened it and poured his gatherer ornaments into his palm. She peered at the polished stones with bright-eyed curiosity. He picked up the cicada and held it up for her to see. Do you know what this is? There was no mistaking the blue-black gleam of Jungisa, or its characteristic hum when he tapped the cicada's back. Talithale's eyes widened. Khalife, Che? What we call the living stone. I heard that it hummed, but never saw it for myself. He smiled. We call it Jungisa. The hum is not life, but magic. The stones fall from the sky now and again. We believe they are remnants of the sun's seed, scattered across the heavens. It took 10 years to carve this one, and it took me 5 years to master its use. He turned the cicada in his fingers, thoughtful. There are only a handful of Jungisa in all the world. She nodded, fascinated. But then her roomy eyes narrowed at him. In my land, we tell stories of the Khalife stones, and what the priest warriors of the river kingdoms do with them. Ehuru nodded, gazing into her eyes. We use them to hold spells of sleep in place, while we travel with the sleeper into Inakarek, what we call the realm of dreams. Ah, Jay. She sat back, thoughtful. You've come to kill me. Death is only part of what I bring. He lifted a hand and touched her cheek. She was old, weak. He could feel the hair thinness of her tether. With the barest brush of his will, he pushed her into the edges of Inakarek, carefully steering her into a dream of pleasant memory. A vision of her home village bloomed in both their minds. Around him were huts with grass-thatched roofs, goats being chased by children, guinea fowl scratching in the dust. He smelled animal dung and grain dust from the storage house nearby. He saw the tall, handsome youth she'd loved so long ago, and for a moment he loved along with her. With a sigh of regret, he ended the dream there, pulling her very gently back to Honakarek. So near death was she that he hadn't even needed to put her to sleep for that brief journey. She blinked once or twice, and then stared at him. In Gujara, my task is to help guide others into Inakarek, in the manner that I have shown you, he said. He caressed her cheek, admiring the beauty in every sun-weathered seam of her skin, before finally dropping his hand to rest on hers. I have not the skill to heal you, but I can at least see that your afterlife is peaceful and filled with your loved ones and favorite places. She stared at him, then let out a long sigh. What a seducer you are. I never dreamed I would be courted again at my age, or that I would be so tempted to give in. How many women have you had with that silver tongue? Ehuru smiled. None, Elder. Women are forbidden to my kind. But, he ducked his eyes, feeling his face heat beneath her knowing gaze, I have loved many in the course of my duty. Tisowu? Loved them, you say? She cocked her head coquettishly. Do you love me? He could not help but chuckle, though he kept it soft so as not to break the spell of peace. I believe I could, Elder. When I share the dreams of another, it is difficult not to love them. As he said the words, he faltered to silence and nearly flinched from the sharpness of the chill that moved through him. Was that it, then? Had he perverted the Bromartes' gathering because, in the moment after that eerie truce-seeing, he had failed to love the bearer of Hananja's tithe? He had disliked the man already, without cause, simply because he was a barbarian. And then he had allowed that prejudice to overwhelm his sense of duty. He had failed to master his own disgust and fear, as he might have done for another. So lost was he in the revelation that his attention wandered. Telethale uttered another harsh cough, which drew him back. Privately he cursed and thrust his inappropriate thoughts aside. He had meant to keep her calm and relaxed, to ease the coughing. But as she recovered, her sharp eyes laid his soul bare. "You are troubled, priest?" He bowed his head. "Forgive me, old mother. My mind wandered." "Nothing to forgive. A mistake is a small matter." She smiled again. "But you would not know that, would you, poor man?" "Eh?" She turned her hand under his and grasped it, patting the back of it with her other hand. "I can see how they made you," she said, her voice soft despite its hoarseness. "They took away everything that mattered to you, Che. Upended your whole world and left you alone. And now you think love blooms in a breath, and silencing pain is a kindness. Ah, but you're young." He frowned, so startled that he forgot the spell he'd been weaving. "Easing pain is kindness, old mother. And my feelings for the people I help, I don't doubt your love," she said. "You are a man made for love, I think. Your eyes make me want to die, there's so much love in them. But it isn't real. Real love lasts years. It causes pain and endures through it." He was too stunned to respond for several breaths. When he finally found his tongue, he could barely stammer out words. "That pain comes with love, that I can accept, old mother. I have lost loved ones, family, but they died quickly, and I pray thanks to my goddess every day for that blessing. Are you saying it would have been better to let them suffer?" She snorted aloud. "Suffering is part of life," she said. "All the parts of life are jumbled up together. You can't separate out just the one thing." She patted his hand again kindly. "I could let you kill me now, lovely man, and have peace and good dreams forever. But who knows what I get instead if I stay? Maybe time to see a new grandchild. Maybe a good joke that sets me laughing for days. Maybe another handsome young fellow flirting with me." She grinned toothlessly, then let loose another horrible racking cough. Ehuru steadied her with shaking hands. "I want every moment of my life, pretty man, the painful and the sweet alike, until the very end. If these are all the memories I get for eternity, I want to take as many of them with me as I can." He could not accept her words. In his mind he saw again his mother's face, aristocratic and beautiful, marred by streaks of blood. He could smell that blood and bile and the reek of broken bowel. He saw his mother's eyes, staring outward with no one to shut them. Women were goddesses who needed no assistance to reach the best of Ina Karek. But her death had still been horrific. Not at all the queen's death she'd deserved. He looked up at Telethale, and in that moment could see the same ugly ignominy awaiting her. She would cough until her lungs tore to pieces and die drowning in her own blood. How could he leave her to suffer so? No, worse, stand by and watch. I could take her anyhow, came the thought. Gehanu would never know. And on the heels of that thought came a chill of purest horror. Swallowing against the dryness of his throat, Ehuru pulled his hands away from hers. It is your right to refuse the tithe, he whispered. The words came more by rote than conscious effort. Your soul is healthy, and your life does no harm. Remain in Hona Karek with Hananja's blessing. He pushed himself up from the rugs, and would have fled the tent then, but he stopped when she said, Priest, I may accept the pain, but I am not a goddess, whatever your people might think. My last days will be easier to bear if I am not alone. Jay? He heard the plaintive hope in her voice, and nearly wept. In a thick voice he replied, Then I'll visit again, old mother. She smiled. So you love me, after all. Rest well. Rest well, old mother. He left the tent and kept walking forward, his strides brisk, his fists clenched at his sides. Almost immediately he heard the scuffle of feet behind him as Najiri recovered from surprise and followed. The boy asked no questions, for which Ehuru was supremely grateful as he reached the wall of the oasis, dropped to his knees, and gripped the lip of smooth stone as if for life. Perhaps he could dance. Perhaps he should weep. Anything, so long as it took his mind away from the terrible sin he'd almost committed, and the sour taste of dream blood lust in his mouth. He did nothing but tremble there in the dust until Najiri took his hand. Tutunip Niwe Hananja, the boy said, the opening phrase of a prayer. All at once Ehuru's anguish began to fade. Again the boy had proven his worth. There's no more time. I must make him ready to serve her now, for I can do so no longer. Then he bowed over his hands and lost himself in prayer. Chapter 22 Jungisa stones may be touched only by those in the service of Hananja. Law. The reaper does not serve Hananja. It no longer needs a stone. Nies was a fool to think he could escape this nightmare, thought Charis. Now General Charis, elevated to Nias's place. Once Charis might have been pleased with the appointment, and with the oblique victory over his old rival, but no longer. Now he would have given anything to be able to hand the title back to Nias, and the foul duty that came with it. The prisoners knew they were to die. They moved reluctantly, only after much shoving and shouting on the guards' parts. Charis could see the despair in their eyes. They could not have seen the heavy-walled, locked wagon that Charis had brought with him to the prison, and which now stood in an adjoining courtyard. They could not have known about the monster locked inside it, yet still they seemed to sense the imminence of death. Criminals they might be, but they were true Gujarin as well. Because of that, Charis, normally more pragmatic than devout, prayed for them. May Hananja watch over you in the dark places you'll inhabit for eternity, he whispered in his mind. And may you die better than Nias did, for I saw his body when that thing was done with him. Sir? Charis turned to see one of his message riders standing at attention, escorted by one of the prison guards. The rider was sweaty and filthy, all but swaying with exhaustion. Charis narrowed his eyes and ordered the guard to go fetch lemon water and salt. Then he pointed toward the floor, and the rider gratefully sat. Report? Orders were delivered to the southeast garrison by messenger bird 2 days ago, the rider said. Another bird was dispatched from there to the southwest. The southeast commander distrusts birds for critical information, so he sent me to deliver the message to, he hesitated, to the high desert. I killed a horse getting there, but delivered the message successfully. On the return journey, I passed through the border town of Ketuye. The minstrel caravan crossed the river there a 4 day ago. Just 4 days. You're sure? Barring storms or accidents, the fastest desert route to the Kisawati Protectorate's northernmost trade town was usually 7 days. Ketuye was a day out of Gujara. They would be past Tessa by now, half their journey completed. Yes, sir, but the desert commander assured me that his troop would be able to catch up to the caravan. They have good trackers, and they have Shadoon horses, bred and trained for the high desert, and twice as fast as any camel. Which meant that it would take another day, perhaps two, for the garrison troop to find and catch up with the minstrel caravan. Right at the border. Sharas could only pray that Seshotanap, the commander of the desert force, would have enough sense to send his men without Gujarin livery. All they needed was for a Kisawati patrol to catch a party of Gujarin soldiers where they weren't supposed to be, dispatched from a garrison that wasn't supposed to exist, trying to kill a Kisawati ambassador. War was coming. Sharas wasn't blind. But an incident like that could precipitate it sooner than the prince wanted. And if that happens, I'll be lucky if he only beheads me, which reminded him of the task at hand. The guard returned with a salt biscuit and a cup of lemon water, which he held for the messenger, as the man's hands would not stop shaking. "Take a 4 days' rest," Sharas said. "But you must leave this place to do it. Guard, help him to the stables." The messenger started and spilled a little of the water down his chin. Out of habit, he wiped his chin and licked the moisture from that hand. "Sir, begging your pardon, but my horse is half dead, and I'm not much better. You may have a fresh mount from our stable, but you should go quickly." "It's a whole extra day to the city from here, sir." Sharas scowled. "Stay then," he snapped. "But when you hear what's about to happen, and the sound haunts your nightmares for the rest of your life, remember that I tried to spare you." He turned on his heel, ignoring the messenger's confused, "Sir?" behind him. As he walked off the parapet into the tower stairwell, he heard the prison guard telling the messenger to leave and not be a fool. Ah, but of course. The prison guards had witnessed this horror before, though on a lesser scale. They knew what was to come better than Sharas himself did. On the ground level, the warden of the prison met him, his craggy face tight with nervousness.
Your guest has been restless, sir, the man said, turning to walk with Sharas. We tried to put food through the window bars, but he growled at us and flung it out. We could try again.
No, Sharas said. He reached for his hip pouch and took out the rough chunk of Jungisa stone that the prince had given him. Food isn't what he hungers for right now. Make certain your men are out of the courtyard, and then wait. He walked through the arched corridor that led to the other courtyard. Normally, prisoners were let out to exercise here, but at the moment the dusty yard held only the reinforced wagon. The horses had been unhitched to stop them from chafing against the harness. They kept trying to get away from the wagon. As Sharas walked toward it, he heard nothing from within, though he sensed the attention of the thing inside. The window shutters had been nailed closed, save for the one used to feed its occupant. This one was barred, but as Sharas drew close, he saw only darkness within. He stopped just beyond the range of any arm that might extend through the bars and took a deep breath to school his thoughts. The prince had given him explicit instructions, but between the pounding of his heart
and the knowledge of what was to happen, he could barely remember them. Then he heard something stir within the wagon. A halting voice, thick and clotted, spoke from the darkness.
"Is it sunset, brother? Will we go out tonight?"
Sharis swallowed and tapped the back of the Jungisa to set it humming. "Not tonight," he said, keeping his voice soft, no louder than the stone's hum. "But there is work for you here. Can you feel them? Gav—" he faltered, sought another word. "Assembled nearby. 100 men in the next courtyard over. They have been judged corrupt and require your aid." There was a shifting sound from within the wagon, the faint clink of chains.
"I feel them. So many." Then the voice hardened. "So many corrupt."
Sharis swallowed. "Yes. You must take them, brother. All of them at once. Do you understand? From where you are, without touching them. Can you do that?" The scrolls were explicit, the prince had told him. In every account, reapers could do this and more, Sharis. See without eyes, kill without hands, drink life like wine and spit back wonders. Magic to rival the gods themselves. Don't you want to see that for yourself? Not for all the riches in existence, Sharis had thought, though he'd known better than to give that answer aloud. Within the wagon, Sharis heard a long, slow breath, as though the creature tested the air through the barred window.
"Filth and hatred. Do you feel it, brother? Their fear?"
"Yes. That one Sharis didn't have to feign. I feel it."
"Filth."
The Reaper's voice was hard again, almost angry.
"They always fear us. No faith. Blasphemy. I must purify them all. I must.
The first screams caught Sharis by surprise. He thought there would be some warning, but Sharis could still hear the creature muttering to himself within the wagon, even as the individual screams blended into dozens. Then a great chorus of anguish, which then began, voice by voice, to fall silent. Then the chorus resumed, closer by. Sharis turned toward the archway and froze in shock. The warden stood there, his body rigid, his face twisting into an expression like nothing Sharis had ever seen before. Though his eyes were shut tight, asleep, it was the guards who were screaming at the sight of him. The warden himself was silent. As Sharis watched, the warden began to shake all over, his hands clenching and unclenching in rapid spasm, urine splattering the dusty ground beneath his loin drapes. His eyes snapped open suddenly, awake, but not awake, white as cowrie shells. The muscles of his neck stood out in taut cords as his teeth ground audibly.
"No," Sharis whispered.
"No faith," snarled the Reaper. It was happening all around now. Throughout the prison fortress, the prisoners were dead. The guards were dying.
"No!"
Horror woke Sharis from his stupor at last. He ran to the wagon and banged on the bars.
"Stop it! Not them! They are your brothers! You shouldn't! Not them!"
"My brothers would not fear," came the voice from within, sounding more lucid now. More than lucid. There was a fierce, gleeful undercurrent in its voice.
"Stop it, gods damn you! You're killing everyone!"
Something moved in the shadows, and then suddenly the Reaper was at the bars, his eyes, the color of pitted iron surrounded by bloodshot whites, saw beyond the world into some nightmarish place Sharis prayed he would never visit. Housing them was a painfully gaunt face, skin stretched so tightly over the bones that it shone like leather. That skin crinkled now. He expected to hear the sound of its flexing and folding like dead leaves, in a rictus that Charis realized hours later was the Reaper's attempt to smile.
"I do not kill," the Reaper said.
Nearby, the last of the guards fell silent, staring into those eyes, wishing he could close his own. Charis abruptly became aware that the only sound he could hear other than the wind was the Jungisa's soft hum. Everyone else in the prison was dead. Everyone but him. "Only the Jungisa protects me," he realized. And as that understanding came, his hand began, treacherously, to shake. He whimpered, sensing with instinctive certainty that if he dropped the stone, the Reaper would take him. He could see that in the thing's mad eyes. It, for Charis could no longer think of the Reaper as a man, would burrow into his mind and rip loose his tether and drag him into the dank, shadowed cavern at its own core. There it would devour him mind and soul, leaving his flesh behind to rot. As if hearing his thought, the Reaper nodded slowly. Then it moved back from the bars, fading once more into the shadows. By then, trembling uncontrollably, Charis dropped the Jungisa. It fell into the dust and stopped humming, leaving only the low sigh of the wind. Some time passed. Later, Charis could not have said how long. He had no thoughts during that time, as he waited for the first cold, invisible caress of death. But as his mind gradually resumed functioning, he became aware of slow, heavy breaths from within the wagon. The monster, having fed, now slept. Charis looked up and saw that the stars had come out, framing the massive hemisphere of the rising dreamer. By its multi-hued light he bent, stiffly, and picked up the Jungisa. After a moment's thought, he set it humming again, and attached it to the gold and lapis collar his wife had given him at their marriage. The stone's faint whine resonated against the metal in a monotone song. That song comforted him as he finally turned to make his way out of the courtyard, heading to the stable to find the horses. For a moment, the prospect of riding through the night, with that thing hitched behind him, almost made him stop thinking again. But the Jungisa's song gradually lulled away his fears. It would keep him safe. Even monsters respected some boundaries. He stepped carefully over the messenger's body as he prepared to return to Yanya Ion. Chapter 23. A gatherer shall carry with him always the mark of the Hedewa, her sacred flower, the moon tear. As well, he shall leave his own mark in the form of a lesser flower, for in the execution of her blessing, a gatherer is like unto divine. Law. When Sunandi saw the gatherer go into the old woman's tent, she decided to act. Clenching her fists, she marched after him, intending to denounce him in front of the whole caravan if she had to. And then the boy stepped out of the shadows beside the tent. She stopped dead, suddenly uneasy. Were gatherer apprentices permitted to kill? She couldn't recall. But something told her this one wouldn't care about permission. But then the boy startled her by speaking. "He has sanction. That of the goddess is all he needs, but he also spoke with Gehanu." That shattered Sunandi's rising anger. Her fists unclenched, and she stared at him. "I don't believe you. Not everyone fears death the way you do." There was no scorn in the boy's manner this time. His anger from their earlier altercation seemed to have faded completely. "Go, speak to Gehanu if you doubt me." "I will." She pivoted on her heel before she could question herself. Logic told her that in the time it took her to speak to Gehanu, the gatherer could kill the old woman. But suddenly her courage seemed to have deserted her. The boy's manner had unnerved her too much. In that brief exchange, he'd seemed far too much like his mentor, exuding the same perverse mingling of menace and compassion. That had been an unpleasant reminder of her own status of abeyance, and the even less pleasant knowledge that they could revoke that status whenever they pleased. It had been an error of judgment to discount the boy as a threat, she decided, trying to get a grip on her fear as she crossed the encampment and drummed on Gehanu's tent. Whatever the Hedua did to train its killers had already set its mark deep in his soul. Gehanu called for Sanandi to enter in her own tongue and grinned when she saw who it was, switching languages with the ease of a veteran trader. "Ah, Nefe, I would have thought you'd still be in the baths, enjoying a taste of civilization, spoiled city woman." Sanandi forced a smile, moving to sit opposite Gehanu's pallet. "I had a good soak earlier." "Anu, about my companions."
"The priest, you mean?"
Gehanu smiled at Sunandi's startled nod.
"You have so many secrets. Some of them break loose when you aren't looking."
"So it seems." "Then he does have your sanction?"
"The boy said so. I didn't believe him."
The boy was a surprise. Never saw a young one before, though I suppose they can't spring whole from gourds. "Yes, I told him he could talk to Talithale."
"You..." She struggled to keep her tone polite and not accusatory. "You are aware of what he might do to her?"
"If she wants it."
"His kind don't care whether you want it or not."
Gehanu raised an eyebrow. "Aren't you the one who brought him here?"
"Under duress. I don't trust him. I don't even like him."
"A shame. He seems decent enough."
"For a killer. One of his brothers,"
she faltered as the grief rose again to mingle with her anger, nearly choking her. She pushed the word out around it.
"Lynn."
"The scamp?
She was gathered?"
"No, murdered. That thing that's been running around the city."
"Ah."
Gehanu uttered a soft wail. "Not that. Tell me not." She caught her breath when Sanandi nodded. "Oh, gods of earth and sky. That monster started out as a servant of Hananja, like him," Sanandi said, nodding in the direction of Talithale's tent. "That's why you should stop him." But to her surprise, Gehanu shook her head. "Not my place. The choice belongs to Talithale."
"I told you."
"He said he'd ask her permission. I believe him."
"You can't believe anything he says. Even he doesn't realize how evil he is."
Gehanu's face became stony, and it was only then that Sunandi realized she'd raised her voice in her host's tent.
"Biensha, Gehanu, forgive me."
She sighed, rubbing her eyes. "I'm going mad. I miss Lynn so much. I can't even think anymore." "Forgiven," Gehanu said at once, her face softening. She reached over to take Sanandi's shoulder. "My heart aches with you, Nefe. But Talithale is dying. In my land she would be surrounded by dozens of her offspring, welcomed by all the ancestors buried beneath our soil. Here she is virtually alone, and cut off from the land of her birth. The priest gives her another choice. I have no right to take it from her." Gehanu lifted her pipe, took a long inhalation, and sighed out smoke. "At least with the priest, she will have no pain." Sanandi lowered her eyes, feeling her own grief resonate with Gehanu's. If she could have given Lynn this choice, gathering or the terrible death the girl had suffered instead, would she have done so? She refused to contemplate that question. Instead, she said, "Forgive me for questioning your decision." Gehanu shrugged. "If it comforts you, I doubt she'll accept his offer. We asked her if she wanted to go to the Hedua while we were in Gujara, and she said no. Didn't want to be healed. Just wants to let life happen as it may. I can't imagine an 8-day would have changed her mind.
She'll stay around for as long as she can, just to plague me.
Sonandi smiled in spite of herself. That would be good.
Good? You don't know the woman.
Enough about that. I'm glad you came, because I had something else to tell you.
Oh?
Gehanu nodded, setting the pipe down on its stand. She began to rummage in her robes. The village headman had a message that he wanted to send to Kiswa. Since you speak for Kiswa, she pulled her hand out of a fold and opened it to reveal a tiny scroll. Sunandi caught her breath. It was the same type of scroll that Kinja had always used in communicating with Kiswa's network of spies. She hadn't realized that network extended to Tessa. Kinja must have cultivated the village headman on his own. She took the scroll and opened it, scanning the coded hieratics quickly.
Strange.
Another stray secret?
I'm not certain. It says that some of the Shadoon have seen odd things some ways east of Tessa, in the high desert. Tracks where there should be none. Camels and horses, many in number, and carrying heavy enough to leave lasting marks. Two trackers went east to follow, but never returned.
I don't understand why the headman thought this was significant.
Gehanu frowned.
The Shadoon tribe have lived in the high desert for generations. For one tracker to go astray is unusual. Two is bad.
They could have been tracking a trade caravan too poor to pass through Tessa.
Some poor fools who got lost. A marauder band that killed them, maybe. A lot of marauders, if so, and with a lot of provisions. You can't bring that many horses into the high desert without a reliable source of water and feed.
That doesn't sound like poor lost caravanners.
Soldiers, then? Sunandi shook her head. No, the empty thousand is neutral territory between the Protectorate and the Gujarine territories. It belongs to the desert tribes, really, though mostly because no one else wants it. Neither land is permitted to send soldiers into it. Neither land could. There's nothing out there but sand. Soldiers need barracks. Horses need stables.
She trailed off, even as Gehanu's eyes widened, both of them realizing the truth in the same moment.
And a means of resupply, Gehanu said.
Sunandi nodded, her mind numbed by the implications.
A garrison, near one of the smaller oases, most likely. But how big a garrison? Housing how large a force? There can't be many.
A force of any great size would have left permanent tracks as it moved through the desert.
But then, she drummed her hands on her legs, thinking, it doesn't have to be a large force. Just enough to strike Kisua's defenses from an unexpected direction in advance of Gujara's real armies. With such surprise they could take the northernmost cities of the Protectorate, establish a foothold before our army could get back to fight them. Her hand trembled, and she clenched it around the scroll. Even with Kinja's warning, I never dreamed the prince was this mad.
Gehanu watched her, nibbling her bottom lip a bit.
I'll send word around the camp. We'll leave well before dawn, and move with as much speed as possible.
Sunandi nodded. The sooner we can get this news to Kiswa, the better.
Not only that, Gehanu gave her a small pained smile. Those trackers went missing, because there's an army out there trying not to be noticed, killing anyone it finds. If some of those recent tracks came from messengers bringing orders to that army from the city where someone tried to kill you, I think maybe they will be trying hard to find us.
Che?
The evening desert chill had set in, but that had nothing to do with Sanandi's shiver.
Ah, Che, she whispered.
Ti Sawu. Gehanu smiled again, turning to a saddlebag that sat nearby. She flipped it open and pulled out two cups, followed by a polished gourd engraved with decorative carvings.
Here, you need to sleep tonight.
Sunandi raised her eyebrows as Gehanu gave her a cup and poured a generous amount from the gourd into it. Panareya wine, a potent spirit made only in the far southern countries. In spite of herself, she smiled down at the little cup. I'll need more than this if I'm to sleep any time soon. I promised I'd take care of you, didn't I? Grinning, Gehanu produced a second bottle from the bag, then nodded toward the already opened one. That one is yours. Third Interlude. Now that you have heard the greater stories, I must begin the lesser. For I see that you have grown weary and distracted. No, don't apologize. We are men of the Hetewa, after all. Sleep is no hindrance. There, take the couch. Sleep, if you wish. I'll weave the tale into your dreams. It began with a madman. In the days when Gujara was new, we had only flesh healing in those days. The castes of the city began to take shape. Those Shunha nobles who had settled here from Kiswa split into two groups. The Shunha, who wished to uphold the ways of Kiswa as much as possible, and the Zinha, who wished to make Gujara something new. The former kept to themselves and preserved the most important lore of our motherland, while the latter mingled with outlanders and adopted many of their ways. Each group needed the other, for without this mingling of tradition and progression, Gujara could never have established herself as a powerful trading nation so quickly. Yet each group scorned the other, too, for the divisions between them were deep. Two things kept them together: love of Hananja and hatred of our enemies. In those days, Gujara was threatened by the Shadun, a proud tribe from the desert, who beheld Gujara's growing wealth and coveted it for themselves. They believed us soft because of our civilized ways and our belief in a sleeping goddess. But time and again we drove them back when they sent their raiding parties to test our defenses. It was the great General Mahanaset who led our army in those days, a man born pure Shunha, yet also learned in the ways of foreign lands. His victories were brilliant, his strength in battle legendary. All loved him, from soldiers to the most rigid elders. Yet, as time passed, his leadership began to falter. First he lost one battle, then another. Rumors drifted back from the battle lines of strange behavior. Mahanaset gave orders to soldiers long dead, charged screaming at phantoms no one else could see. The protectors of the city, for we did things like Kiswa in those days, began to worry that it would be necessary to replace him, which would be a terrible blow to the people. If Mahanaset fell in battle, the city would revere him, and the armies fight harder to avenge his name. But if he were set aside, the city would be wounded by sorrow. With the Shadun hovering near like scavengers, we dared not weaken ourselves. Thus did Inanru, the founder of our faith and head of the Hetewa at that time, intervene with a possible solution. In the ancient knowledge of narcomancy brought out of Kiswa, there existed a secret form of healing that had been forbidden in the motherland because it brought death as well as life. Yet applied properly, the secret art might have the power to do what the Hetewa's healers otherwise could not: restore a broken soul to peace. Yes, you understand now. It seems strange to think that something so valued in our society today was once feared and misunderstood then. But this was the beginning of the change. Mahanaset was brought to the Hetewa, raving, sick, unable to tell reality from phantasm. One of the Hetewa's priests, a dying old man, offered himself as the donor of the dream. Inanru himself performed the transfer from one to the other. And in the process the city beheld not one, but two miracles. The first was the restoration of Mahanaset's sanity. He leaped up from his sickbed whole and healed in every way. The second unexpected miracle was the joy with which the old priest died. "Hananja, I come," he is said to have cried in his sleep before the end. There was no doubt that the old man had died happy, for Inanru shared his joy with everyone present. Many wept to know that he had experienced such peace. The rest you can guess. Mahanaset resumed control of his army and led them in a devastating strike against the Shadoon, forcing them to pay tribute, barring them from the local trade, and assuring the world of Gujara's strength. The dying began to come to the Hedawa in fours, then in hordes, choosing peace over misery and pain. The afflicted were brought to the Hedawa as well, and sent away sane or healed in body. When Mahanaset returned from his victorious campaigns, the people were so joyful that they made him their ruler in place of the protectors, naming him king as barbarians do their lords. But he refused this. "This is Hananja's city. As I am Hananja's servant," he said, "she can be the only true ruler here. I will rule in her name as prince, and claim king only when I take my place at her side in Inakarek. And I will rule with the guidance of the Hedawa, without whose wisdom Gujara might have fallen." And so it was. Under Mahanaset, the Hedawa's law became Gujara's law, and Hananja's peace became the prince's gift to the people. And thus did it begin that we honor Hananja above all others. Chapter 24. Members of the four paths to Hananja's wisdom are permitted to put aside propriety and the order of command, so long as this is done in service of peace. Law. The superior of the Hedawa sat in his office, enjoying the sounds of early morning, and wondering again how long it would be before his gatherers came for him. A day and a night had passed since the meeting with the prince, and its aftermath. Usually when he returned from such meetings in the small hours of the morning, few of the Hedawa's denizens were about. Only the two sentinels who served as his bodyguards, the ones on guard duty, and the handful of sharers on night duty. Sometimes a few sleepy acolytes accompanied the latter in their contemplation of the sentinels' or sharers' paths, and a few apprentices assisted their older brethren. But as the superior had passed through the Hall of Blessings that morning, Robina had been there, kneeling at Hananja's feet, but not praying. The gatherer instead faced the hall's entrance, and he had not donned his hooded robe. He was still on duty. Shocking to see him like that, the superior reflected, with his back to the statue. A snub to Hananja, though a mild one, since after all the statue was only a statue. But Robina's gaze had been fixed on the superior, his face unsmiling, his gaze a condemnation. "There is only one affront to Hananja here," those eyes had said. And with that, the superior had known his final tithe had come due. He had spent the time since confined to his rooms, ordering no visitors so he could pray and contemplate and prepare himself for Hananja's peace. During the night he had inadvertently fallen asleep and been astonished to wake up alive. There would be no time to brief Teacher Matan, his chosen successor, in the secrets that came with the mantle of superior. Those secrets had all gone wrong anyhow. Perhaps if they died with him, the Hedawa might survive the coming storm. The beaded front hanging rattled to announce that someone had entered his quarters. The superior tensed, then forced himself to relax. Only a council messenger, or a sharer responding to an emergency, could violate the superior's privacy when he requested it. And gatherers, of course, they went wherever they pleased. He opened his eyes. They stood on the other side of his desk, solemn, still dressed in their sleeveless, formal robes after the morning's tithing ceremony. Not a gathering, then. The superior wasn't certain whether to feel relief or annoyance.
We would speak with you, Brother Superior, Santayi, sounding as though he'd come to discuss the weather. And perhaps this meant no more than that to him, with his peculiar sense of right and wrong. Doubtless it was Rabana who needed the explanations and details. For Santayi, it was a simple matter. If the superior was corrupt, then the superior would die.
Yes, the superior said. I've been waiting.
We come to speak only, Rabana said. He sat in the chair on the other side of the superior's desk. Santayi remained standing.
An assay of truth, then.
I should thank you for your consideration, the superior sighed, though a part of me would prefer you get this over with.
Explain, Santayi said. Perhaps we shall oblige you.
The superior rose, going to a nearby cupboard. He opened it and took out a red bottle, wrought of glass by one of the greatest craftsmen in the city. Gatherers shunned drink for their own pleasure, but sometimes they would partake on a tithe-bearer's behalf.
Drink with me, brothers. I'm not quite an elder yet. I'm not ready to spend my last hours alone.
Is this a confession? Rabana watched his face intently as the superior took three red glasses from the cupboard and set them down on his desk.
Are you asking for Hananja's blessing?
The superior paused for a moment, considering, then sighed and began to pour.
Yes, to the first question. No, to the second. I would like very much to live. But I know the law of this land as well as you, and by that law, her law, I am corrupt. Whatever you may think of me, I have never wanted to be a hypocrite.
He paused, taking his glass and nodding for them to take the others. Rabana hesitated, but then took one. Santayi did not.
Instead, Santayi said, whether you wanted it or not, you have become one. Only a hypocrite would decry our brother as a rogue, then allow the prince to take him away. If you believed him dangerous, he should never have left this Hetawa in the care of his brethren. But Rabana says you acted on the prince's orders.
For just an instant something flashed across Santayi's weathered face. Curiosity.
How is it that the superior of the Hetawa, Hananja's foremost servant, follows any orders save hers?
The superior lifted his glass and took a sip, savoring the sweet, clear taste. A Jiro liqueur, one of the few Northland delicacies he had ever liked.
You must understand, I did not know everything at first. The prince is a master at concealing his plans. For 3 years even I was fooled. Now I know the truth. The prince is quite mad.
Rabana's face was implacable. Good-humored Rabana, who had been hot-tempered Rabana in the years before he'd become a gatherer. Fascinating to see that something of their old selves could surface at times like this.
Then he should be given dream blood and healed.
The superior fought the urge to laugh. He covered it by taking a long swallow from the glass instead.
He was given dream blood. That was how this nightmare began.
Ah, but it had begun long before that, in the birth throes of Gujara, and even before that in Kiswa. He should confess it all to them, tell the whole truth so that they could experience the same shock and horror and disillusionment that had afflicted him since he'd found out.
No. The words of his predecessor drifted back to him, full of loathsome wisdom. A servant of Hananja exists to ease Gujara's pain. The role of the superior is to ease the pain of his fellow servants. There are secrets that would destroy your brethren. It is your duty to bear them alone.
Bear them and be crushed beneath them, it seemed.
The prince killed his father to gain the throne, the superior said, gazing into the red glass.
Such things happen. But when an Enket, our prince, pardon, took the aureole, he immediately began to show signs of a dangerous instability.
Among other curious acts,
he sent a force to Kaitian and had slaughtered every one of his father's wives and other children, down to the newborns, including his own mother. Only Ehuru survived, because the Hedua had laid claim to him by that point. He paused, thoughtful. Some say Ehuru's mother had the gift of true seeing, and knew the slaughter would come. We shall never know for certain, as Ehuru does not speak of his past. Perhaps because it has nothing to do with the current situation, Santai said. The superior smiled. He envied gatherers their ability to see the world in simple terms. Peace and corruption, good and evil. A superior had no such luxury. It has everything to do with the situation, Brother Santai, but I appreciate your impatience. He took another sip of the liqueur. The Hedua's duty seemed clear. We offered the prince dream blood, as a privilege of power, you see. The upper castes of the city whisper that it far surpasses Timbaland or any other pleasure drug. The fact that it heals the mind is something they neither understand nor care about, but it suits our purposes. So a sharer was dispatched to provide the dream blood and perform the healing. But the sharer found there was no madness to heal, not in the physical sense at least. His humors were in balance. His head had suffered no injury. The prince's excesses were committed in perfect sanity. Corruption, Robina said. He scowled on the sunset throne. It has happened before, the superior said, taking care to keep irony out of his voice. They were already angry enough. A certain amount of corruption is inherent in any position of power. For the peace of the city, we tolerate it. But what is relevant in this case is that the prince, as a result of our attempt, tasted dream blood. He demanded more. Santai was staring at him with narrowed eyes, perhaps sensing his prevarication. To avoid the gatherer's probing gaze, the superior drank the last of his liqueur, which delved a pleasant fiery trail down his throat. You didn't give it to him. Robina's eyes were wide as he understood, or thought that he understood, the danger. In quantities sufficient to heal. The superior sighed. A prince who can slay his own mother is capable of many things, Gatherer Robina. It took a moment for understanding to sink in for Robina. When it did, he caught his breath. He would not dare threaten the Hedua. Ogujara would rise up against him. He would never threaten openly. But make no mistake, though the Hedua and the Sunset Throne purport to share power in the city, along with the high castes and the military, the prince is stronger than any one of those groups alone. Ordinarily we have the support of the people to balance this weakness in our favor. Any attempt to control the Hedua by any power of the city would be seen as an affront to Hananja herself. Even the servant castes would take up arms on our behalf. But in this case, the prince had a weapon to counter that as well, the weapon we had given him. He would claim that the healing marked the Hedua's attempt to control the throne. He saw the quintessential horror of that sink in for both of them. The Hedua, publicly accused of corruption? Unthinkable. Intolerable. They were both so very, very pure. So now the sunset controls the Hedua of Hananja? Santai folded his arms. Foul as this circumstance is, it doesn't explain your secret meeting with the prince in the small hours of the night, like some skulking criminal, or the fact that the subject of conversation was our brother. You will explain. The superior's fingers tightened on the glass. Clever, Robina. Not just following him, but eavesdropping as well. So much for protecting them, then. He prayed their faith would survive the truth. It had taken many years for his own to recover. It is in part that Ehuru is his last living brother, the superior said.
I believe he enjoys having his brother's life in his hands at last. The rest of it, understand, my gatherer brothers, that even I didn't realize the lengths to which the prince was willing to go.